Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What makes a great pair of glasses? At Warby Parker, it's all the invisible extras without the extra cost. Their designer quality frames start at $95, including prescription lenses, plus scratch-resistant, smudge-resistant, and anti-reflective coatings, and UV protection, and free adjustments for life. To find your next pair of glasses, sunglasses, or contact lenses, or to find the Warby Parker store nearest you, head over to warbyparker.com. That's warbyparker.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
Holiday magic is in the air, and DSW's got all the shoes to make your season extra merry. Believe, you've got parties to attend and lists to check twice, so DSW is taking care of the details, like gifts to make their eyes all aglow, styles that bring joy to your world, brands everyone wants, like UGG, Nike, Birkenstock, and more, and deals to make your budget bright. Find the perfect shoes for you and yours at a DSW store near you or DSW.com.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. They ship Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT.
Welcome, everybody, to this week's exciting episode.
Yeah!
That was exciting.
I caught you off guard on that one.
You did, yeah. I always wonder what you're going to do every week, and yeah, that was a good one.
I'm running out of ideas already.
Right? Try a different word.
Pickles!
Fair enough. Well, we've got a book dive. This
Ooh.
Week. It's not just going to be this week. I can tell you now that I'm never, ever getting through this book in one session. I'm looking at about three.
That's okay.
So 3 weeks covering the story. And then on the fourth week, I've actually got the author coming for an interview.
Lovely.
Because this story, it's just an amazing one, man. I mean, it's very spiritual,
mm-hmm.
very, very paranormal.
Ooh.
It's going to push the boundaries of what you believe.
Oh.
Really, it really is.
You've already tickled my teeth.
Yeah, yeah. We've got ghosts. We've got ancient mysteries, artifacts. It's kind of like Indiana Jones or National Treasure, you know, the Nicolas Cage Ooh. Film where he goes around and he's got to find clues to get to the next
yeah.
bit. And, you know, one part rolls onto another. This is very much like that. In fact, this is actually part of a series of books by more than one author, or the people who are actually in this book, mm-hmm. the characters, have almost, well, at least another two of them have written their own books called The Green Stone and The Eye of Fire.
Ooh.
And I'm going to be covering those two books in this first episode. This one, The Chronicles of Mjolnir, is kind of a summary of those other two books. And then it goes on to tell the rest of the story after those two books. And I believe Giuseppe La Rosa, the author of this one, is currently writing another book sort of as an explanation to this one. You know, his beliefs and you know, in the encounters. And why it didn't quite go to plan. You see, this book, there's a group of people... I think they call themselves the group of the Mionea group. In fact, I'll let the story explain it. But they're very spiritual, but they're like mediums.
Oh, okay.
At least a couple of them are really, really like powerful mediums, but they've all got this sort of gift of intuition. And they say at the sort of start of the book that, you know, the people who have joined have joined because it's kind of their destiny to do so.
Or like their calling in life.
Yeah. Ooh. So Giuseppe La Rosa, or Joe, is not part of the very start of the story, which I'm gonna go into. I might as well read the first couple of chapters, mm-hmm. just in its entirety, because Joe explains what's going on so much better than what I could.
Okie doke.
And then we're going to have to start stepping it on a little bit. I might have to miss a few bits out, or just, you know, whitewash over them a little bit. But I mean, it's a very, very interesting story. You can pick it up on Amazon yourself. I can't remember how much I paid for this now. It was a few months ago that I bought it. But I mean, it's a hell of a story. I'm going to have to leave some of it out, but it's well worth reading yourself. Anybody at home that wants to sort of fill in the blanks, if you like, it's definitely worth buying and reading. So without further ado, I suppose I shall dive in.
Go for it.
Our first book dive of the new year, of our second year of podcasting.
Yeah, season two.
So much like last year when we did the Doddleston messages on that lead up to Christmas. This one's going to be this year. So, excuse me. The introduction is called The Calling. In the autumn of 1974, after a UFO encounter, an Essex family revealed through channeling information from an alien source that during the latter half of that decade, a mysterious intelligence would bring a group of people together in central England to perform some important tasks. In 1976, a young girl's encounter with a UFO in the Welsh countryside became an important factor in events that began to unfold a few years later. During the latter months of 1979, the earlier Essex family's prediction appeared to be taking root as unusual events began to manifest in the depths of England. In the Midlands, men, women, and children began to receive identical psychic messages concerning a quest to discover small green gemstones. Circumstances brought a group of these people together, and, guided by an unknown intelligence, they took up the quest to find the green stone. They had been informed it had been lost from the pages of history. The group received psychic information concerning the history of the precious stone, which, they were informed, had been manufactured in ancient Egypt by the pharaoh Amenhotep I, husband of Nefertiti. Amenhotep was the pharaoh who changed his name to Akhenaten, and who introduced a monotheistic religion to Egypt. Channeled information stated that Akhenaten had been the recipient of a secret knowledge that had been passed down to him. This knowledge had been brought over to Egypt by the adepts and initiates of the megalithic people, known to the Mionea group as the Larn of ancient Britain. Knowing their civilization was in decline and wishing to preserve their secrets, they migrated to Egypt and passed their wisdom on to the Egyptian initiates. There, the green gemstone was cut and polished, then imbued with the secret knowledge, it was placed on top of the Great Pyramid where it received daily the full power of the sun. Following the death of Akhenaten, and not wanting the green stone of power to fall into the wrong hands, his followers took the gem and travelled northwards in search of the land from which their knowledge had originated, England. They eventually reached Britain in the last decade of the 14th century BC and settled in the dense forests of central England on a site known today as Bury Ring. The psychic information went on to say that centuries later, a powerful warrior queen arose called Guevara, who was a direct descendant of the original colonists. She became known as Gwenhwyfar, a legendary warrior queen who in later times became transformed to Guinevere, the wife of the fabled King Arthur.
Oh, okay.
After her death, the knowledge of the Green Stone was known only to a few and was kept cloaked in the veil of secrecy. The holders of this knowledge were a small group of people known as the Nine. Throughout the Roman occupation of Britain and into the Dark Ages, those who became the linear successors of the Nine perpetuated the knowledge as a secret inner lore. According to the psychic information, the stone then passed through history until it eventually fell into the hands of the Knights Templar. The Templars had been formed by nine knights in 1118 after the First Crusade had taken Jerusalem, ostensibly to protect pilgrims in the Holy Land and the city of Jerusalem. From the Knights Templar, the Green Stone eventually reached the hands of Mary, Queen of Scots. The psychic information being received went on to say that Mary, while imprisoned in Tutbury Castle in Staffordshire, had been visited by a certain man called George Wintour and his young nephew, Robert Catesby. Mary must have seen something in the young man because she gave the Green Stone, which she had renamed the Mionia Stone, an anagram for I Am One, to Robert Catesby for safekeeping. In 1604, Robert Catesby hatched a plot to destroy King James I and the Protestant Parliament. Catesby's plan was to blow up the Houses of Parliament, and he was going to use the power of the Green Stone to help him to succeed. The plot failed, Guy Fawkes was caught, and Catesby and his fellow conspirators were pursued into the Midlands, where most of them met their death. It was believed that the Green Stone had been passed to a gentleman named Humphrey Packington, who lived at Harvington Hall near Kidderminster. With this information, Graham Phillips and Andrew Collins, two members of the group searching for the stone, arrived at Harvington Hall. Looking around the old house, they noticed a set of murals called the Nine Worthies, painted on a wall. They discovered that the murals, which featured nine famous people from history and stylized posed, had been commissioned by Humphrey Packington himself. The two friends wondered if Packington may have left a clue to the whereabouts of the Green Stone in the murals. He was thought to have been the last recipient of the stone before its disappearance. It was possible that the information they needed was right there in front of them. Using further psychic information and their own logic, they cracked the code that Packington had left for those he knew would come after him. The code they discovered was based on the stylized pose of the mural figures and a sword thrust known as the St. George's Parry, and also on the number 9. It was then they were informed that to discover the stone, they would first have to find the sword, which would point the way to the whereabouts of the green gem. One night, Graham Phillips and another member of the group, Andrew Collins, arrived at Severn Stoke, a small village situated in the heart of the Midlands. Close by lay a small body of water which was known locally as Knight's Pool, and by it was an old stone bridge. Using the symbolism of Packington's code, they counted 9 stones across and 9 stones down in the foundation of the bridge. Managing to dislodge the 9th stone, they discovered a short sword lodged in the recess where the stone had been. With utter disbelief, the two companions hurriedly departed the scene and sped home with the sword bound safely in cloth. And there is the sword.
Wow.
On the page. There is a picture of the actual sword. It looks ancient, but there it is. Later that night, they arrived at Graham's flat in Wolverhampton and immediately began to clean the sword of its accumulated grime. To their surprise, they discovered etched into the blade were the words, Mionia for Mary. They realised that at that moment that the Mary etched into the sword could only be Mary, Queen of Scots. They had already been informed that Mary herself had called the Green Stone the Mionia Stone, and Mionia was also etched into the sword, convincing evidence of the gem's existence. Group were informed of the discovery of the sword, and a short time later, 5 of the members returned to the bridge. Gaynor Sunderland, a young girl who, together with her mother, Marion, were members of the group, held the sword in her hand, and applying her psychic abilities, used the sword to pinpoint the area in which the Mionia stone could be found. She indicated that in the distance there was an old ruin they would have to go to. The ruin was the crumbling remains of an old castle, but with the tower still intact. Gaynor knew that she had to go into the tower, so Graham Phillips led the way and Gaynor followed him. As they approached the top of the tower, a loud noise startled them. sounded like agitated beating of large wings. A chunk of masonry came crashing down, and fearing for their safety, Gaynor and Graham turned around and hurried back down the stairs. They quickly left the scene unsure of what had occurred, but Gaynor knew deep inside that they had been brought to the tower for a reason. Time was not on their side, for the group had been told that they had to find the stone by the night of Halloween, which was only 2 days away. Believing that the Mjolnir stone must be in the general area of Knight's Pool, the group examined a map and discovered that on the River Avon, which was about 4 miles away from the pool, there was a bend on the river called Swan's Neck. They knew that Mary Queen of Scots had been associated with the symbol of a swan. Could this be where the stone had been hidden? They thought to themselves. It was a distinct possibility. That night, in the family home in Wales, young Gaynor Sunderland had a dream of a beautiful white swan flying away from the old tower. Around its long, graceful neck hung a leather pouch tied by a cord. Gaynor knew without a shadow of doubt that inside the pouch was the green stone. The following morning, not knowing of Gaynor's dream but understanding the urgency of the situation, Graham decided to go by himself for a short reconnoitre of the Swan's Neck Bend. His intuition was telling him the stone was there. Knowing time was of the essence, he drove straight over to the Swan's Neck, and using the psychic information he had been provided and his own psychic talents, he dug where he believed the green stone was buried. He unearthed a brass casket. Inside, to his belief, lay the green stone. This is it, he thought, the Mjolnir stone of Mary Queen of Scots, of the Knights Templar, and of the ancient Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten. Next to the green gemstone sat a small oval-shaped black stone. Graham instinctively felt that it was the guardian stone, psychically programmed to protect the Mjolnir stone. Deftly, he placed his trowel under the black stone and in one swift movement flicked it high into the air. He carefully watched the stone as it flew through the air, landing with a plop in the flowing waters of the river. Clutching his prize, Graham made his way back to his car and drove away. That evening, in Marion's home in Flint, where the Mjolnir group had convened, Graham revealed the casket to his comrades and lifted the lid. The group gasped to their utter astonishment as they saw the Mjolnir stone lying there. It was true. It actually existed. After all the time they had spent searching for it, it was now right there. It proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the psychic information was correct and that the entities guiding them existed in some form, somewhere. But what now? What happened next to the group, thought to themselves. They were informed that the Mjolnir stone was to be used to combat a force of evil at a place called White Lady's Priory. It was about this time, in the latter half of 1981, that I became aware of the Greenstone quest and its continuing saga. So that is how it all started off. Like I say, it's a very spiritual thing. These people are mediums. They get this psychic information just out of the thin air.
It called to them.
Yeah, it's calling to them. But as you can see, there's a little brass casket. There's the green stone.
It's very old looking.
Yeah.
I wonder why he flicked the brown or the black rock into the...
Well, he said he intuitively thought it was a guardian stone. So the black stone was guarding the green stone. So possibly had like a hex on it or something like that.
Oh, okay.
So he's flicked that away to get rid of that possibility. We're going to see more evidence of guardians.
Okay.
And like spirit guardians.
I'm liking it.
Throughout this. It is quite a compelling read.
Mm.
That is just a summary of how they got hold of the green stone to start with. The next stone is like a yellowy orangey. It's called the Eye of Fire. So it's, yeah.
Mm. I've got a couple things I want to mention with that chapter that you read though.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
Very, very good. I was listening to your every word. The first thing, Queen Nefertiti.
Yeah.
I know of that because my brother has like a condition where he's got pressure in his eyes. He had to have laser eye surgery.
Right, yeah.
So most nights he has to have like a ritual, if you will, where he has to put like cold presses on his eyes and reduce the pressure and things like that. So when he comes home for Christmas and my mum sees him doing it, she calls him Queen Nefertiti.
Oh, really?
Because it's a very feminine ritual that he does. And also, I've noticed there's some really good parallels there. And I hate to bring it up, man, but the Rise of Skywalker, Star Wars, right? They actually use a dagger that has like a map to find the holocron, which is a glowing like green orb stone thing.
Oh, right, okay.
So when you said that they had to find the sword to then find the gemstone, that was quite a good parallel to that.
And that is how this story kind of go, particularly this first episode that I'm doing on it, that we're going to be covering the first two books, the Green Stone, which we've just covered, and now the Eye of Fire. It is very much, it's like you got to find one thing that'll direct you to the next point, and then the next point, and the next point. And it really is kind of almost like a Dan Brown novel, you know, where you know, the Da Vinci Code or whatever. But obviously, this isn't a novel. This is actual historical fact.
This actually happened.
And it is quite funny because all of their mistakes are in the book. You know, they don't get everything perfect. They don't do every ritual 100% perfectly, but they still manage to just scrabble their way through and to success, to a certain extent anyway.
It makes it more realistic, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like we don't really edit our podcast unless we have to. Mm. And I feel like that kind of makes it more genuine. So the fact that they're owning up to their mistakes and showing you like, yeah, you know, we did do this wrong or we didn't quite get this right, to me, it makes it more realistic.
Yeah. But it also, because like, I mean, this does kind of culminate in sort of a climax, if you like, but it also anti-climaxes. Like right at the end of the book, and then it sort of peters into this alternate sort of story. We'll cover it. We'll get there, but you can see it's not. You wouldn't make a film out of this book because it doesn't have that Hollywood ending.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, there isn't that massive success, and we all lived happily ever after. There is a bit of a weird ending to it.
Oh, okay,
but like you say, it just makes it more believable.
Yeah.
But anyway, as we move on, they've found the Green Stone, and this is the point where our author, Giuseppe La Rosa, who likes to be called Joe.
It's a very Italian name, that Giuseppe.
He is Italian.
He
is Italian. He's now basically writing in first person this part of the book. So in late November of 1981, I received a phone call from Chris Hewitson, a friend who was a reporter for the local evening newspaper, the Evening Sentinel. He asked if I could arrange to see me to discuss something that he thought I might find interesting. Out of curiosity, I arranged to meet him the following day for a drink at a local pub. I am going to flip through this a little bit. With an understated excitement, his friend Chris related that through psychic information, a group of people had come together in the Midlands and discovered a sword hidden in a bridge. But not only that, they'd also uncovered a brass casket that had been buried in the bank of a river. In the casket was a green stone. Some of the group were local to Stoke-on-Trent, and Chris eagerly stated that he had met one of them. "I've arranged to interview him next week, and I'd like you to come along," he said tentatively. "Okay, Chris, I'll come with you," I replied. I was intrigued by the story. An uncanny feeling told me that I should find out more about what was going on with this group of people. The day of the interview arrived, and that evening I drove to the pre-arranged meeting place on a car park of a public house in Blythe Bridge. Chris was waiting for me. A bearded gentleman was with him. He introduced me to his colleague, a fellow reporter called Dave Carter. Dave had also been intrigued by the story and wanted to come along. With formalities out of the way, we all climbed into Chris's car and made our way to the destination. It was a small hamlet tucked away in the surrounding countryside. Before long, the headlights of the car highlighted a white building in the distance. "That pub's my landmark," Chris stated. "We turn right here." Nearly there, so they went down. You know, they're going down country roads and whatnot. And Chris said, that's the place. So they went in. So Chris introduced us to the homeowner, and we were ushered in out of the cold night air. The cottage was quite cosy, and wooden beams running across the ceiling. Glancing around the room, my eyes were immediately attracted to a small recess containing a bookstand. One particular book stood out. It was about the Knights Templar, and there were several others on esoteric subjects that I was familiar with. A person after my own heart, I thought to myself. We chatted informally for a short while with our host, Terry Shotton, and his wife, Pat. They appeared down-to-earth sort of people and were very friendly. Terry was in his late 30s with a thinning, sandy-coloured hair and a slight paunch. Pat was slim and attractive, with dark hair and occasional silver streak running through it. On first impressions, I thought they were a very pleasant couple. So they had cups of coffee and were discussing the story that they'd come to hear. He told us of the discovery of the green stone at Swan's Neck by the River Avon. I questioned Terry as to the origin of the stone, and he stated that they believed that at one time it had been in the hands of the Knights Templar. At that moment, I recalled the story from Wolfram von S. Echenbach, sorry, a German troubadour who lived in the 12th century. He wrote that the Grail was a green stone and was protected by Templison, a direct reference to the Knights Templar. I mentioned this to Terry, and he informed me that they already had that information, and he was surprised that I knew of it. Other facts were discussed, some of which I had prior knowledge of, and by this time I realised that I wanted to become involved in whatever was taking place with the group. For some time, I had had a strange feeling that something was awaiting me. While Terry Shotton had been relating his story, an eerie sensation had come over me, almost like deja vu. I knew instinctively that this was what I had been waiting for and wanted desperately to become involved. It was now quite late and time to return home. We thanked our host and his wife for allowing us to hear the story firsthand and then left. Driving back, Chris asked my opinion of the Green Stone story that Terry had written. What you're really asking me is if I believe the story is true, is it not? I replied. Yes, Chris said. It sounds a bit far-fetched to me, Dave Carter retorted. Well, I believe what Terry has told us, I stated, weighing my words carefully. Knowing what I know, it is well in the grounds of possibility that those events have occurred. In fact, I have decided to call Terry Shotton tomorrow to see if I might be allowed to join the group. You're convinced then, Joe? Chris said. Yes, I am. I knew without a shadow of a doubt that something momentous was occurring and I wanted to be part of it. We reached the pub car park, they parted ways, and the following day, Joe rings Terry and asks him if I would be allowed to become involved. He responded by inviting me back to the cottage where I met another member of the group, Alan Beard. During our conversation, Terry asked me the origin of my surname. He was curious to pinpoint my nationality. I'm Italian, I replied. My surname, La Rosa, means the rose in Italian. So Terry and Alan looked at each other curiously. I realised that my surname had some meaning to them, and from that moment I felt an air of acceptance. The following week, Terry invited me to travel to Flint in Wales with him, an invite which I accepted without hesitation. In Oakenholt, near Flint, I was introduced to the Sunderland family. Marion and her daughter Gaynor were part of the group already. It was Marion who held the green stone. I was allowed to hold the stone as it nestled in the palm of my hand. I wondered what power it held, and if it really was connected to the Holy Grail, as had been mentioned. A few days later, Terry invited me once more to his cottage, and I was introduced to Graham Phillips, the medium of the group. Having heard so much about him, especially his incredible psychic abilities, I did not know what to expect. As I walked into the cosy living room of Terry's country cottage, a tall, wiry figure confronted me, and Terry introduced us. "Pleased to meet you, Joe," Graham replied with a friendly smile, held out his hand. "Hi, Graham," I responded as we shook hands warmly. They had pleasantries, had a chat and a coffee, and then Graham asked, "So you'd like to become involved in the project, Joe?" "Yes, I would. You don't know what you're letting yourself in for, you know." Terry has already mentioned some of what has occurred. I believe that I can help because I do have some knowledge of the occult. "What do you think, Terry?" Graham asked, glancing at Terry, who was sitting comfortable in his easy chair. "He'll be all right," he responded. "As we've said in the past, if you are meant to be involved, you will be." Graham paced up and down the room, took another puff of his cigarette. "Do you have to smoke?" Terry said. hope I don't sound elitist, Graham said, taking a long drag of his cigarette and blowing it directly at Terry. It's just that we have to be sure that you fit in with everyone else. So they do accept him. I'm looking at the time now. We're already half an hour in. I haven't really got that far with it. But yeah, they accept him, and he's slowly integrated into the group. The first outing that they go on without him, and they tell him that they had to go to White Lady's Priory to battle a force of darkness.
Mm, yeah.
And it does go into what happened with them there. Joe wasn't involved with that. He was a bit new. They didn't want to take him. They wanted to protect him. So that's what they did.
So are these guys a group of, you said the Mioneers?
The Mioneer group, yeah.
So is it all to do with the Green Stone then? And they kind of got these side missions to find out the power of this Green Stone?
What it is...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in details.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. They ship Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT.
Each of them have to find a stone. And then they have to find the chalice of Mionir and to perform this ritual to receive the knowledge of the afterlife, the truth about what is out there.
Okay.
In the end.
Right.
But they have to go through these trials to find each stone individually, and then they have to go through the rituals, and all the time they've got the forces of darkness trying to
Beam
away. Okay, so now we move on to like the actual Eye of Fire, and I think it's Gaina that receives a vision. Yeah, it began with a vision in which Gaina Sunderland saw a lady on a horseback galloping towards a manor house. On her arrival, she hastily descended into the cellar, then quickly returned. Gaina could sense a dread fear coursing through the woman's body. She was being pursued and needed to get away. The lady ran out of the house and galloped away on a horse into the surrounding countryside, rain teeming down from the blackened skies. Soon the sodden woman arrived at a church-like building and, opening a small purse, tipped an object out onto her palm. Translucent, elliptical, orangey-red stone. The vision changed. The woman was now galloping along a desolate country road in unrepentant rain, beating down around her. Gaina felt the fear that coursed through the woman's body. Behind the fleeing woman, the three men on horseback were deadly pursuit. Attempting to distance herself from the adversary, she began to ride across the water in sodden countryside. Her escape continued across waterlogged fields and ditches, horse and rider taking fences and hedgerows with stride. But behind them, the three riders continued their relentless pursuit, gaining on the tiring rider in front. Ahead of them, the rider appeared to jump a fallen tree trunk. The horse twisted and fell, throwing its rider heavily to the ground. They spurred their horses on as their prey lay unmoving on the ground. Within a few moments, they had arrived at the scene, the woman still lying immobile on the floor. The three men dismounted, gathering around the nigh lifeless body of the woman. A sinister, tall, bearded man turned the lifeless form onto its back. Gaina sensed the aura of evil that permeated every fibre of his being and shuddered coldly. She knew that she had been witness to the woman's death and that the year was 1865. This woman had been the leader of the Order of the Mionir. Her successor was Mary Heath. The psychic information revealed that Mary had once lived at Biddulph Grange in Staffordshire. The tall bearded man was identified as John Langley, a black magician who had caused the downfall of the order 10 years later in 1875. Another one of Gaynor's visions pinpointed that Mary Heath had been the last recipient of the Eye of Fire. In order to stop the stone from falling into the hands of John Langley, she had disbanded the group. In December of 1875, she stayed with an old friend, making plans to hide the Eye of Fire before leaving Mary. Before leaving, Mary hid something in the house. This object was a bell, but the person who was entrusted to retrieve the bell had unfortunately died before being able to do so. So this was their first port of call. Find the bell. The bell would lead them to the stone. Okay. So to not read everything that's in this book, because obviously we're already over half an hour now, they go to Ranton Hunting Lodge, which is an old derelict building. This is where Mary Heath had hidden the bell. And I think they have to do it by nightfall. But it's a huge manor house, derelict now, and they all go in there looking around, dying of the day, the sun's going down, and they have been given this psychic information that the bell is under the watch of a spirit called the Guardian. And as they're searching for this this bell, they're looking through all the rubble and, you know, all this sort of thing. They come across graffiti that said, "This place is haunted. There is a ghost here." Yeah. So I think some people have had encounters there anyway.
It's a real mysterious sounding place.
Yeah. But as I said before, they don't always get things on the money, and they don't actually find the bell until after the sun has gone down. They're out of time. They had to do it by sundown to deactivate the Guardian, but because they didn't find it until after sundown, the Guardian's still there, and he's still raging angry, trying to protect the Eye of Fire, basically.
So could he be linked with the ghostly activity and things that...
Yeah, he is very much linked with activity that at the start of this book, and he's very imperative to the mission, really.
Oh, okay.
Because they then have to... What they end up doing is they go to some caves, I think, in Wales. I'm not going to read it all in detail now, but they have to go to this cave in Wales and perform a ritual where they ring the bell and ask for the stone, which again they kind of mess up a little bit, but it does work out for them, and they end up having a visitation from this Guevara, the ghost of Guevara, the warrior queen from ancient times.
Okay, nice.
And she tells them that they've got to go to a point and ring the bell to receive the information on how they can gain the stone. And again, it's all psychic information, and they find out that they've got to go to a place in Norfolk, not too far from here. It used to be a windmill, but it's now known as St. Bennet's Abbey. And so they travel over to the Norfolk Broads. They hire a boat, like a little river cruiser, and they go. They make a little mission, going up the Broads. They find St. Bennet's Abbey. There's a photo of it here, as they were there at the time. But then they carry on sailing past it. I don't know why they sail past it at this point, but they do. I think they were looking for a pub or something that they could have some dinner or something like that. Mm-hmm. So they're moored up for the night. They've gone out, or some of them gone out to the pub or whatever. But Joe and I think it's Graham, are on the deck of the boat, and they can see St. Bennet's Abbey, just, you know, a couple of fields away or whatever, and they say that as they're sat there watching it, this strange orange light appears over the top of the abbey and just remains there hovering for quite a while. They see it, obviously wondering what it was and whatnot, and they tell the others when they come back. So, yeah, here it is. "What the hell," I exclaim in amazement, as the light dropped into the building and out of sight. In stunned silence, we watched as in the distance, the abbey became alight with a bright, brilliant red glow. A halo of incandescence, burning red light, enveloped the building. The fiery luminescence pervaded all within the walls of the ancient sanctuary. "There's something strange going on," I remarked to Graham and Terry as we looked at each other. They nodded in agreement. "I don't know what that was," Terry stated, "but it might possibly be connected to the Eye of Fire." "Well, it seemed the right colour," Graham acknowledged. "But whatever it is, we need some answers. I believe that we should have a seance and try and obtain the answers. Perhaps Guevara or Mary Heath might communicate with us. I know there is only three of us, but it's worth a try." So Graham and Terry agreed. Fetching a pen and paper and scissors, we made a circle of letters and numbers on the cabin table. A glass was put in the middle. We were now ready. "I'll be the scribe," Graham said, picking up pen and paper. Terry and I nodded in agreement and placed our index fingers on the upturned glass. "Is anybody there?" Terry inquired in a loud voice. For 30 seconds we waited for some sign of movement. Terry's face, a picture of concentration, but nothing was happening. I was just about to speak when the glass began to move. Like a skater on ice, the glass moved effortlessly across the table. "Who are you?" asked Terry. The letters spelt Mary Heath. The glass returned to the middle of the table. "Thank goodness you've come," Terry exclaimed. "Can you tell us anything about the red light we saw over the abbey?" Again, the glass moved and it spells out, "The red light you saw is the advanced light of the Eye of Fire moving closer to your dimension. The secret held within the walls of the abbey has been activated. You must be within the great bell tower at sunrise. The bell must be rung within that sanctuary at that time. Beware the guardian, for it is then that he will strike. The guardian is getting stronger, and I do not know if I can control him. I must go now. Communicate again at 11. Now, in the meantime, before they actually set off on this, while they were doing that whole ritual in the cave, Marion was at home. I don't know if Gaynor was with her, but Marion had a visitation from the guardian. Like a spooky visitation where it appeared to her as her own decaying corpse.
Oh. Okay, so it's got paranormal.
Quite threatening.
Yeah, scary.
Now, obviously, they're now actively trying to find this Eye of Fire. The Guardian's going to be coming after them. Terry's got the bell.
Where was the bell?
Oh, it was in that manor house.
It was in the manor house.
Yeah, they did recover it. But do you remember I said they didn't recover it in time? So the Guardian is now after them.
Oh, okay. It's all linked.
Yeah. So the next morning, they wake up bright and early before sunrise and turn the boat around and start sailing back towards St. Bennet's Abbey. They get collared by some fishermen. Apparently there's a fishing competition going and they can't sail down the river.
Well,
so they have to turn back around again. Time's against them at this point, remember. They've got to get there at sunrise. So they've got to find an alternative route. And they do. But they've got to literally go by foot through all this marshland. Terry's got the bell with him. And he keeps getting attacked by an unseen force, knocked off the path into the marsh.
Wow.
So they have to keep going back and pulling him out of like deep mud and bogginess and stuff. And by the time they actually get to the bell tower, ring the bell and ask for the stone, it's too late.
No.
Sunrise has already happened. But like I say, they never ever get it quite spot on. There's always like a mistake and they got to catch up afterwards.
Mm.
So they go back to the boat and they're a bit depressed. And I think they do another seance or something like that. And they decide to go back to the bell tower just to see if there's any lingering...
spirits or anything?
Yeah, sort of information that they're getting, psychic information, lingering information. And that's what they do. And then while he's in there, I'm not sure if it's Terry or Graham. It could be Terry, I think. He says he's got this fleeting sensation that they've got to stick to the river. Yeah, okay. That's the information that he's. It's not clear, but that's what the sense that he's got. So they carry on exploring the river. They're trying to feel this psychic information being fed to them, and they're like, "Oh, let's go this way. Let's go that way." It ends up like there's a raging torrent and storm going. You know, they're all day out on the river. It's starting to get dark at night. But they managed to find this place where Terry's had a vision of, which is like just a small coppice of trees next to the river. And they moor up the boat there, and they do another seance. Mm-hmm. And they get hold of Mary Heath again. And they say, "Thank God you've come," Terry exclaimed. "We were unable to retrieve the information from the Abbey because the Guardian hindered us. Can you tell us if there is anything we can do?" Glass moved again. "Even though you were too late to retrieve the full information that I had left at the Abbey, you still have managed to arrive at the place where I last came. You have made only one error, for you should be on the other side of the river. I will return at 8. So they unmoor, they get over the other side of the mirror, the river, moor it up again, wait until 8 o'clock, get another message. "This is Mary. You have done well. All is not lost, for there is still a chance. My creation, the Guardian, is the key to the stone. You must try and communicate with him and explain why you are here and what you have to do. Graham's body will have to be used. The Guardian is now very powerful. I cannot stop him. You are in God's hands now. Good luck. If all is well, I will communicate later." Now, they realize, because one of them gets possessed by the Guardian, Martin, I think his name is, and it's Martin. He attacks Graham, and then they realize that the Guardian is Martin. Graham murmured and sat bolt upright. His breathing was long and shallow. I glanced at Martin. Even though he was still out cold, I think they had to knock him out. He appeared to have returned to normal. The Guardian was gone. All attention was turned to Graham as he began to speak. He's in a trance. "It is I, Mary. The Guardian has gone now, and you will be able to obtain the stone. But first you must answer a question. It is a test to see if you are worthy of the Eye of Fire. Who is Mjolnir?" They're all kind of just a bit perplexed by that one. Mary says, "I need an answer." And Terry says, "Well, we all have different ideas of what Mjolnir actually is, but essentially we think it's God." Mm. And Mary replies, "That is correct. But because you seem to differ, I cannot allow you to take the stone." For a moment we were struck silent. After all our efforts, victory was being snatched away at the last moment. "Well, that's unfair," Terry replied caustically. "Every person has a different image of God, but essentially we all know that it is one and the same thing." "I will be back," Mary replied. Graham went silent. So they have to move Martin. Graham goes back into another trance. "It is I, Mary. It has been decided that you may obtain the stone. You will need Graham for this. He will know what to do. You have done well, my successors. Now may Mjolnir be with you." Graham's chin dropped onto his chest. Mary Heath had gone. The communication was over. And Graham wakes up. Graham's got this psychic information of what's got to go on. And they get a visit from the White Lady. Graham says, "Oh, the White Lady is here." Terry ring the bell and ask for the stone. Terry holds the bell at arm's length, struck it firmly with his pen. A clean, pure tone rang out. "I have come for the stone," he said loudly. As if in answer to his request, a high-pitched whine, like a large electrical generator, began to resonate around us. "What the bloody hell is this?" I exclaimed in astonishment. "And where the hell's it coming from?" Jean and Susan, two of the other people that were with them, gripped my hands tightly, their mouths open in amazement. "I've heard that sound before in the garden," Terry exclaimed excitedly. "Joe, Jean, Susan, start chanting 1-8," Graham ordered. In unison, we began to chant 1-8, 1-8, 1-8, 1-8 in an unceasing flow, forming a resonance that I could feel vibrating through my whole body. The high-pitched whine stopped abruptly. "Ring the bell again, Terry, and ask for the stone," Graham said. Moving towards the small flight of stairs that led to the deck, Terry held out the bell again and struck it hard with his pen. "I have come for the stone," Terry stated firmly, as the note vibrated across the boat. "Now chant 8-1, Graham responded, beckoning us to start. 8-1, 8-1, 8-1, 8-1. We three started chanting. The numbers meant nothing to us, but we realised that they must somehow be important. Graham stood silent as we chanted for nearly a minute, while Terry waited expectantly for something to happen. "Right, Terry," Graham suddenly cried, "we've got to go outside. You three have to stay here. When you hear Terry ring the bell, start chanting 1-8 again." We were a bit disappointed, but we watched them go outside. The sound of the bell rang out crystal clear in the night air. We realised that the rain had seemingly stopped and it was eerily calm. Down below in the cabin, Jean, Susan and I heard our cue. 1-8, 1-8, 1-8, 1-8, we began to chant rhythmically. I could hear Terry's muffled voice asking for the stone. A high-pitched whine rent the air, sending a shockwave through the boat. A thrill ran through my body, goose pimples rising up on my skin. Jean and Susan seemed awestruck as we continued to chant the magical number. Something caught my eye. As I looked out through the exit door, the darkness outside was torn away. A whole area around the boat enveloped in a brilliant white light, almost immediately framed in the cabin porthole. A large burning crimson ball of fire appeared in the trees close by now. I could not believe my eyes. "Good God," I cried out in astonishment. "What is that?" Jean and Sue strained to catch a glimpse of the burning ball. Whatever it was, it hovered in the branches for a few moments, then shrunk in size before dropping out of my sight. I wondered what Terry and Graham were doing outside and what they were seeing. Heavy thuds above us warned that one of our companions was returning. Terry appeared from out of the darkness. "It's unbelievable," he said, his voice full of emotion. "I've just seen the White Lady. Graham was actually standing inside her. Three balls of white light appeared in the sky above us. The White Lady then just rose up into the sky and all became one single ball of white light. It just shot off and disappeared." Sudden noises outside alerted us that something may be wrong. "Ow, ow, ow," sounded like Graham's voice, and then all went quiet. We waited in hushed silence for Graham's return. Surely the guardian had not struck when we were so close to retrieving the stone. Heavy footsteps proclaimed that someone was coming. Our eyes became fixed on the door. A dark, ominous shadow glided down the steps towards us. A tall black figure appeared silhouetted in the doorway. It stepped into the light. It was Graham. For a moment we all stood silent, staring at each other. Terry could not contain himself. "Have you got it?" he cried out, his eyes begging for confirmation. Graham stood silent, an enigmatic look on his face. He held out a clenched fist and slowly opened his hand. There, lying on the palm of his hand, was a small orangey-red stone, the Eye of Fire. I stared down in disbelief at the Eye of Fire. It actually existed. Somehow we had opened a dimensional doorway and had retrieved Mary Heath's stone. What awesome occult power she must have had to have placed it beyond the reach of our arch-adversary, John Lane. And, well, that's that, really. That's pretty much the end of the chapter. They just kind of take it home and show everybody, the whole group. And that is where I am going to leave for today. What are you thinking, Josh? What are your impressions of this?
Wow. I mean, there is a lot going on there.
It's quite an exciting one, isn't it? And I've missed out so much because I can't fit it all in.
I am liking it so far. I am liking it. I've got to mention it because I know there's going to be someone thinking it. It sounds a lot like Infinity War by like the Avengers collecting stones. But all jokes aside, I find that very interesting.
Yeah.
The fact that they're not just how do I put this nicely? Like, I want to be very respectful to Joe as well. It's someone could come along and say they've buried these stones beforehand and it's just an elaborate prank or whatever.
They could, yeah.
But the reason I don't think they have is because they've gone through a lot of stuff. Like, you've got ghosts in there, you've got guardians, you've got mm-hmm. the paranormal, you've got psychic abilities, you've got artifacts that they've actually found and got hold of. And different dimensions are now being mentioned.
Yeah.
They've also travelled.
I'd just like to point out, because obviously those two stories, the Greenstone and the Eye of Fire, were Graham and Terry, I think, wrote two books only covering those events.
They
hadn't even got to the rest of this, what's in this book. So why would they hoax that? Because there's no reason for it, just to get a stone. Oh, great, wow.
Yeah.
What's it for?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And that's what I'm actually intrigued to see where it goes, is what do these stones have? Like, what powers do they have? And another thing that it's pointed out to me is everyone kind of associates ghosts with just staying in one place and haunting one building. But it's very interesting that they can reach out, and this Mary, is it Mary of Heath?
Mary Heath.
She can almost be summoned to speak to wherever they are. And same with the Guardian. The Guardian obviously is following them and trying to stop
them from
getting these artifacts.
There is kind of a bit more going on with the Guardian that I didn't really go into in this episode, because it is very, very prevalent. It keeps it torments like Terry and Pat at their house. They keep having visitations, like you say. It will present itself to them as their own decaying corpse. You know, they have a vision of this, and it's really psychically attacking them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they need their psychic abilities, so that's what it's trying to scrape away at, you know, trying to lessen their abilities.
And the other reason I think it gives it credence as well is it doesn't seem to be just Terry getting the visions, or like you said, there's that, is it, was it Guinevere?
Gaynor, the young girl. Yeah, she's quite psychic. Graham is the main medium.
Yeah, so they've all got these abilities. They've
all got this intuition. That's what sort of drives them to even join the group in the first place, is they have to have this intuition. And there's a thing we'll cover next chapter where Joe has to, they all have like their own personal challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Joe has his, and even though he manages to complete his challenge, he doesn't report back to the group on the right day. They all like they arranged to meet on like a Saturday or something like that, and Joe turns up on the Saturday, and they were like, "Oh, you should have been here 2 days ago." Apparently, the powers of B said that you failed your challenge because you weren't intuitive enough to turn up. But I mean, that'll be in the next episode. I'll tell you about that. But they've all got that kind of gift, and you know, that gut feeling, if you like.
Well, I'm very intrigued to see where it goes, because I'm a fan of Indiana Jones. I like artifacts. I like ghosts, paranormal stuff. And, you know, emerald stones happen to be my favourite kind of stone.
So. They've all got to get a stone. I think there's, what, 8 of them or something? And when
I was going to ask you how many stones there are altogether.
I think it's 8. But there's also like a chalice and like this ring, the four wraith rings and all this sort of stuff that they've got to go through. And when I showed you this book the other night, you picked out a pattern in here somewhere. I can't find it now. There it is. The Tree of Life. So each one of these circles in this pattern is represented by a stone, I think, if I can remember rightly. We'll cover that.
Yeah.
So, to start with, they've just got to go around collecting these stones and find the Chalice of Mianmia, which is what we're going to go into next time. But for now, that was the Greenstone, the Eye of Fire, and Chronicles of Mianmia. We were doing 3 books in one just then.
Yeah. And that's just the basics so far.
I'm literally taking a lot of the meat and bones out of it and just giving you the bare back of it. But I mean, obviously, for anybody at home listening to this, if you want to buy a copy of the book yourself and find out all the missing pieces that I can't cover in just an hour of episode, then I really do recommend this book. It is a good read, very compelling. the first time I read it through in like 2 days straight, it's just one of those that you can't put down when you start going with it, you know.
Yeah, any avid readers out there?
Yeah. So no paranormality scale this week.
No.
We'll wait until we get to the end of the book, and then we'll do the paranormality scale, and then the week after we'll obviously have the interview, and we'll have Joe LaRosa's actual personal...
I've already got questions for him. So
yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Good, good. I hope you've got plenty for him in a few weeks' time. And yeah, until next week, I guess, when we carry on with the Chronicles of Mia Nia. I've been Pirate.
I'm Josh.
This has been Paranormality UK. Ta-ta.
Ta-ta.
Hey, guys. Have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. They ship Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT.
Every idea starts with a problem. Warby Parker's was simple. Glasses are too expensive. So they set out to change that. By designing glasses in-house and selling directly to customers, they're able to offer prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Warby Parker glasses are made from premium materials like impact-resistant polycarbonate and custom acetate. And they start at just $95, including prescription lenses. Get glasses made from the good stuff. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.
This is a mini meditation guided by Bombas. Repeat after me. I'm comfy.
Comfy.
I'm cozy.
Cozy.
I have zero blisters on my toes.
Blisters.
And that's because I wear Bombas. The softest socks, underwear, and t-shirts that give back. One purchased equals one donated. Now go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com/ACAST and use code ACAST at checkout.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.